Pull up a chair, the stories begin. Patrick and Randy are letting you in. From the desert lights where the big names are, it's Big Conversations, Little Bar.
Welcome to Big Conversations, Little Bar, the Coachella Valley's favorite podcast, recorded live at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert. Get ready for another fascinating hour of meeting people who make the desert city such a spectacular place to be. Now, nestled in their corner booth perch, well lubricated and raring to chat, here's Patrick Evans and Randy Florence.
All right, Howard, thank you very much, better known as Ho-Ho.
Ho-Ho.
Howard Hoffman. That's one of the great broadcast names of all time.
It is. I wish I had a friend named Ding Dong. This would be a perfect afternoon.
Ho-Ho and Ding Dong. But you can be Ding Dong. That's Ding Dong Florence.
I thought he was fruit pie.
Only according to Terry Ray. All right. We are here at the...
If you see my eyes getting big, I have no idea what you're talking about.
That's our guest.
Right now, neither one of us know what we're talking about.
We're going to get to Eddie in just a moment. My name is Patrick Evans. That is Randy Florence. And we are here at the corner booth at Skip Page's Little Bar for another edition of Big Conversations, Little Bar. Randy, I want to congratulate you again. The Desert Theater League Awards have come and gone now. You were nominated. You did not win, but it was...
What?
You were there.
I didn't win?
No.
It was...
But congratulations. Everybody... It was your first time doing that. You get a nomination right out of the box, which I think is really impressive.
Thank you. Nobody knows the topic of suicide plays better than me, so I've done several of them already, and I'm getting really good at them.
Be careful. Don't get typecast.
But I also wanted to... This Valley already knows what a cool guy Patrick is. I think he anticipated that perhaps I was a little disappointed that I hadn't won, so he shouted me out. He didn't announce any of the other people who lost during the night, but he did announce me, so I thank you very much.
They don't co-host a podcast with me, so they don't get a shout-out, but you get a shout-out.
No, you did it just because you're such a fantastic guy.
Did you say, I want to acknowledge the Biggest Loser?
I did not. I did. That would have been funny, but I did not.
But he did throw out the podcast. So.
I did.
Oh, that's good.
He's marketing for us.
That's right. I'll send you a bill for it, John.
Okay.
Now, Randy, you wrangled Eddie for us.
Yes.
Which, and I give you high marks. This is he's got a lot of great stories, but I'll allow you to introduce our guest today.
One of the things that's really cool about our show is we keep getting referrals of guests from people who have not been guests and are just friends. And Eddie is the second guest that we've gotten from a good friend of mine named Todd Hooks. Todd's sitting over there. Thank you, Todd. Eddie Gilreath. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, you did.
It's Eddie.
Yes, it is. Okay. Eddie Gilreath, and believe it or not, is Scottish.
Scottish, seriously. Yeah. Eddie may not be Scottish. It's just a guess on my part.
It's good. My grandfather was Scottish.
Was he?
Yeah.
Thank you for being here, Eddie. Eddie, is your history within the music industry has just been amazing. I finished it about 5 pages of research here. Ooh. But talk a little bit, if you would. I want to start early on in the history of how you even got involved in the music business. So where were you born?
I was born in Maryland, actually. And that was some number of years ago. Not necessary to mention them.
No, we weren't. And, no one's counting.
My father was in the Second World War, and he decided he didn't want to live in Maryland, and he moved my family, or our family, up to Pennsylvania. And I was in the Philadelphia area, and this is where we became very much involved in the music, because if you look at Philadelphia, that Philadelphia sound, there were so many musicians and artists that came out of Philadelphia.
Frankie Valli, Buddy Greco.
Oh, yeah. And it's so strange.
Dion.
Oh, yeah, Dion.
My favorite.
And then Frankie Avalon.
Yeah, Frankie Avalon.
Because we used to shop at the same store on South Street called Crash Brothers. That's where we went to get the shiny shoes and the shiny pants and all that. So we would all hang out together. And
Bobby V came out of that area,
yeah,
too.
I think he did, yeah. Then we were on South Street, and that's where Patti LaBelle And then LaBelle had some of their shows that we used to play down there all the time. And so my mother said, if you're going to live here, you got to learn to play something.
Yeah.
And my sister was a great pianist. She had a master's in music. And so I said, I think I'll play guitar.
Okay. But that wasn't your first answer to her, was it?
No. I'd rather play basketball. But she insisted that I learn how to play. And yeah. I think she was a musician via our limited talent, because she always wanted to play, but she was not very good. So her mother
she was living
played
vicariously through you,
yeah,
and your
basically
sister.
That's what she was doing. So I had to do an hour a day of rehearsal. Otherwise, I couldn't go out and hang out with the fellas. This one particular night, and I make this a short story, it could be much longer. There was a gentleman that had a band called J-Mo Thomas. He had a song out called I Spy for the FBI. And it's an old song, but it got some recognition, got some chart action. And one night up in Philadelphia, they had these things called cabarets, and they would have these big halls, and the band would come and play. And you would bring your own bottle in a paper bag, and everybody had a great time. So this one night, the band was there, and they had a gentleman by the name of, his nickname was Stump. And because of that, he was short. That's why his name was Stump. And he got a little drunk that night and couldn't show up for the show. So J-Mo called my mother and said, hey, get Eddie, have him come up here. Now, I've been practicing guitar for 3 or 4 years, learning how to play. I could read pretty good, but I wasn't a bass player. She said, get him to come up here. I need him. Tell him to put on some black pants and a white shirt, and he can wear Stump's jacket. Since Stump was short via the name, I could step in and put on his jacket, because we had to have 9 musicians on the bandstand, because if the union guy come in and you don't have the right amount of musicians, which you said you would have based on the contract, you can get fined. I said, okay. So my mom came and got me, and we went up there to the Philadelphia location. And I put on Stump jacket. I got on the stage, and my first time in a professional setting, and the headliner was D. Clark. Remember D. Clark had Raindrops?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Wonderful song.
Yeah.
So he was out there singing. I'm back here act like I'm playing. And they told me, don't you turn that bass up. Don't you turn that bass up. Because I want to turn it up. See,
you wanted to get going.
And so I couldn't turn the bass up, so I act like I was playing for the entire show. So the next day I said, hey, Mom, I think I want to learn how to play bass. And she gave me something like $25. I went to the pawn shop, got an old Sears K bass, if you remember those.
Oh, yeah. My son.
And I've been playing bass ever since.
Wow. Very cool.
That's how I got started.
And did you continue with that band?
No, oh no. J-Mo was, see, I'm still in school. I'm 14 years old.
He did 15. Keep Stump's jacket, though.
No, I didn't want that either. Had a little odor to it. So I left that there. But we had a great time doing that. And I said, you know what? I'm enjoying this. Maybe this is something I want to do. It wasn't my main goal in life for a career, but I knew it was something I enjoyed doing and I wanted to do it. And she started sending me to get bass lessons. But there was a really good drummer in the area who worked with me on my timing. And he was just a horrible person, just really mean. He would sit there and drum, and if you're not keeping up with his drum, staying in time, he would stop and look at you and want to smack you upside your head. But that's how we learned. And then then you go start playing with bands, and you're going to mess up. But that's how you learn the songs, how to play with people, and how to become a musician versus sitting there practicing every day by yourself.
And did you think at that point that you were going to stay just as a musician?
No, because I thought there was a lot of careers I wanted, believe it or not. When I came out of high school, I went to aeronautical school.
Really?
I wanted to study the principles of flight. What, am I 18 years old? I want to know how that plane stays up there. Because if I get on one, I want to know what to do.
I always want to know that, yeah.
I went there for a year. It was a very expensive school. So I said, you know what, I might as well go into the military. Vietnam was on its start. There was that trouble in Panama. And so when I went to the recruiting guys, they said, because of your background, you came out of high school, you're looking really good. And because of that year of aeronautical training, we would like to put you on our reconnaissance aircraft. I said, no, I'm not interested in that, because I have worked on engines, that jet engines by that time, and the last thing I wanted to work on was a 6-cylinder putt-putt.
You want the good stuff.
Yeah, so I said, I'd rather do something different than that. So they put me on missiles and taught me how to put missiles together. So they sent me down to Fort Bliss, Texas, and I was there for 3 months to learn how to put missiles together. Then I was back up to Fort Meade, Maryland. And then one morning, they put us on a bus, took us to Brooklyn, New York, the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and we're on a ship on our way to Guantanamo Bay.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's,
was the music still part of your life during all of that process?
Oh, yeah. Actually, when I was in basic training, someone said, hey, we need someone because we have a Army dance band. If you remember on the Ed Sullivan Show, they would have an Army dance band a couple of times a year. So they put me in an Army dance band. The other guy's out there running through mud.
I'm playing bass. Worked out pretty well for you.
Yeah, I didn't complain. Trust me.
Jamo took care of your life.
Jamo
handed you that bass.
Yeah. So things worked out, and I got more into it. But, of course, now I got to serve 6 years. So,
6 years. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
And you were in Vietnam, weren't you?
Actually, I was in Panama.
Panama, okay.
Which was just as bad at that time.
Yeah.
Because they had all these different events taking place because the Panamanians wanted us out, so we were being constantly harassed. And, Patrick, you're almost as old as me, I think.
Darn near.
You may remember the Bay of Pigs.
I do remember the Bay of Pigs.
So
I know about the Bay of Pigs.
So what had happened was they...
You've read about it, right?
Yeah. After that whole thing ended, and Khrushchev, I think it was, took the ships back, and then they told John, Brother John, the president, to take his missiles out of Turkey, and everything was going to calm down, but that wasn't going to be the end of it. At that point in time, the Russians said, we still want to come down there. The Panamanians wanted us out. So between the Russians, the Cubans, and that's where the missiles were on the ships, and the Panamanians, they started doing all kind of insurgents against us in Panama. So we were in combat zone, getting combat bay, and walking around with M14 all the time.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't realize that the conflict in Panama was that, because it was so overshadowed by Vietnam, people forget that you guys were being harassed and shot at. And
A lot of guys died down there because there was no line between the isthmus where the Americans was with their canal zone and the Panamanians. And you just didn't know where you were sometimes. And you look for a guy and don't see him anymore. What happened to him? You don't know. You'll never see him again. Because they won't let him. I mean, he's not coming back.
Wow.
And so we spent a lot of time doing that. And I was on a little small island called Paradise Island, which had 75 GIs on it. And that's where the missile base was. And I was on that island for 2.5 years. We couldn't leave.
I don't think you would want to either.
Just like if it was in Vietnam, you could go to Saigon, a few places. And we could have went downtown Panama, but you can't go by yourself. But we weren't allowed to leave it off for a long time. So,
wow.
Anyway, so I sat there and we played in the barracks, played in the little rooms, and we kept the music thing going, but that was about it. And so when I did get back, I went back to school, got my paper so I could have some kind of background in sales and marketing, and then I started playing a lot in Philadelphia. Started hanging out with Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff and all those guys.
Okay.
Teddy Pendergrass was my buddy.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Patti LaBelle, and we just played all over the place. And we spent a lot of time on South Street. That's where all the clubs was. And eventually I got a call from Motown. Hey, we heard what you're doing. We like all the announcers in Philadelphia. They like you. You're playing. We like to talk to you. Next thing I know, I'm in Detroit.
And did you know that this was going to be a shift in your career if you moved over to Motown?
Yeah, I decided this is something I want to do. My father always said, you better get yourself a real job.
Your mom's telling me to play guitar. Dad's saying, go get a job.
Yeah.
My dad told me the same thing and did right up until the day he passed away.
Yeah. You better get
a real job.
When you going to go to work? I said, this is it. But so I finally got to Motown. And it was one of those things where whenever you see these movies and you see where Barry puts out his hand and he says, welcome to Motown.
Yeah.
That's what he did. Eddie, welcome to Motown. I said, man, I must have made it.
Now, what year was that?
That had to be like 69, 70, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. And they first put me on what they would call the pop side of Motown. See, many people never knew that Motown had a lot of pop artists. I'm thinking of her name, Kim something. And then we all said Bobby Darin.
No.
On Motown.
On really? Motown?
Yeah, people never knew
that. I didn't know that.
Had a lot of pop art. Tom Clay, who did a, he was an announcer in CKLW in Canada, and he did a spoken word with background music to the song Someday We'll Be Together. No, not Someday We'll Be Together. But it was one of those great songs with, I think Dionne Warwick was one that did it, yeah. The name will come back to me in a second. At this tender age, things tend to slip.
They'll come back around. We got plenty of time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But he puts up with my memory every week.
Oh, gosh. He had a big hit on that record as well. And that they were doing really well. And then my biggest hit over there at the time was the Spinners. It's a Shame. And because they had been lying dormant on that side of the label for the last 2 or 3 years. And they said, Eddie, see what you can do with this. And Stevie Wonder, I think, wrote that song, It's a Shame. So I got with the guys, put it together. I took them on the road. We did a number of important radio announcers and announcements, rather, some TV. And next thing we know, that record blew up.
And was there just like a, was there a path that you needed to follow when you had a new group, certain announcers in certain cities?
You had to think about each group separately and each artist as to what they would be able to do. And a good example of that is George Benson. Mm. Now, when George first came over to Motown, I mean to Warner Brothers when I was there, I had known George before because we used to play in Pennsylvania, and he used to be at a little bar called Lawton's over in Harrisburg, and I would play there as well once in a while, and we would see each other. So we knew each other mildly because he's from Pittsburgh, and I'm from Philly, so we just go to Harrisburg in the center.
meet in the middle.
Yeah, and play. And when he got signed to Warner's, he had never had a pop hit. He had never had anything but jazz, and most of his songs were 4, 5, 6 minutes long. And he did this song called Breezing, if you remember.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful song. And it was like 4.5 minutes long, no vocals, just instrumental. And radio at that time didn't really want to play that.
No, they wanted vocals.
Yeah, they wanted vocals, and they wanted a 2.5 minute song.
Yeah, it had
song.
To be shorter.
It had to be real short because they got so many commercials they had to put into that an hour. I said, okay, George, we got to figure out how we're going to do this. And Motown said to me, and Warner said to me, Eddie, put together a marketing plan. So I'm in this meeting. I'm a managing director, or whatever they call me. And all the VPs are in there. And they said, Eddie, how are you going to break this record? Because they already had signed him without even telling me. And I said, well, let me put a marketing plan together. So I came back in about 3 weeks, showed them the marketing plan. And the only comment I heard was, hell, that's a lot of money, Eddie. I said, it's going to take a lot of money to break George into that market. And there was one, the sales manager, who and I never got along very well. And I had to go talk to him. I had to go in there with a helmet on.
That was going to be a rough meeting.
Yeah, it's going to be rough. You just get ready. And he controlled all of the marketing money. I said, okay. So I told him what I needed when I went back. And same thing, that's a hell of a lot of money, Eddie. Sure? This is what I need. And I know I was putting my neck on the line by saying that, but I said, yeah, this is what I need. So they gave me the money, and the sales guy looked over and said, you better make it work. And they don't know I want to jump over that table and just grab him by the throat. And so I just let it go, and I came out. I called George. I said, George, we got the money. Are you ready to go? He said, I'm ready. So I got with George, we put a plan together, and the first thing I did, I put George on the plane with myself, and we flew to Atlanta, Georgia. And I had Peebo Bryson meet us at this restaurant. Now, Peebo lived in Atlanta and had a strong following.
He was a big deal then.
Out of the South, especially. Yeah. So we go to this restaurant, it closes down, so it's just George, Peebo, and myself in this restaurant. Little soul food restaurant, so we're in there. And I tell people what the plan is, what we need it for. So people, I said, I need your help. Because I had worked with people before. And I said, I need your help in breaking this new record on George. So they got a chance to talk a little bit, got to really know each other, became good friends. And people said, no problem. I will work it out. I'll help you out. I said, all right. And the next day we get on the plane, we go to Miami, Florida, Fort Lauderdale, all through the South, up through Birmingham, Memphis, Tennessee, Nashville, you name it. So we're on a road to about 2 weeks going to different cities.
And traveling was a little bit different back then.
Oh, yeah. You got used to it.
Yeah.
You know, you get in the plane, get on first class, and then the stewardess asks you, or the flight attendant, do you have your seat assigned? Do you know where you sit? I said, do you know where you sit? Get away from me, lady.
I want some peanuts.
Yeah. So we did that whole thing, and it wasn't that funny then.
It's pretty funny now.
So, you know, we started working it, and then we started working in the Northeast, and then I started working the West Coast. And that was, I forgot the month it was, but 3.5 months later, I sold 3.5 million George Benson's albums.
So George must have been pretty happy.
Oh, he was. Eddie, I'm going to buy your Mercedes. I'm going to get one. And I'm going to get you one. So every time I seen George after that, George.
Where's my car? Come where's on, my Mercedes?
George. But Warner Brothers was so impressed with that event that took place. About a month later, they made me a vice president.
Wow.
So that's how I became a vice president at Warner Brothers.
If I read, you were the first African-American national sales director for Warner Brothers.
And then the first African-American vice president in that department.
That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I feel good about it.
Do you understand the legacy behind that, how important that was, or do you ever think about it?
Not really. Yeah. Someone said, Eddie, you're a legacy. I said, I don't want to have a legacy. Everyone I know has a legacy is dead. I don't want a legacy.
I take it back.
Yeah, just keep it.
You just know. Have a great story to tell. All right, I'm going to just... I've got a list that it came from the information that you sent, Randy, and it's just artists. And I'm going to ask you about artists, and I want you to give me a good story, because I suspect you have a story about every one of these folks.
You're going to ask about Cher?
It sounds like I need to ask about Cher. Okay, Eddie, tell me about Cher.
She never smiles.
No.
Very rarely when you're in a meeting. She doesn't say anything, really. She just kind of stares at you. And you start answering the question or explaining something that you've done that you think is very good. And you know how you give a statement, now you're looking for a question to come back? Blank stare. And then you start talking, and you start talking over yourself, because now you feel like you're giving too much information. But that's how she was to work with. And if she lacked it, you had no problem. I was invited to her house a number of times. And
what label was that?
Oh,
Warner Brothers. Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, Geffen.
Geffen.
Because at one time she was going with Geffen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but because Geffen and I were very close, and she knew that, and if you're close to Geffen, no one's going to give you too much of a hard time.
That was a good one to have on your side.
David didn't play. You can, once you tell him what you want to tell him, and he believes you, and he likes what you're doing, then you got it made. One day, I think, who was it? This artist that's a guitar player out of London from, what is it, from the Led Zeppelin band?
Jimmy Page?
Jimmy Page, that's what it was. He had an album out. And we released it just before Christmas. So we're in a marketing meeting, and Eddie Rosenblatt is the president, and we're going around talking about the new releases, what's happening. And I had put the record out already. And so we get to Jimmy Page, and David just happens to walk in cold, wasn't there before, and we're talking about Jimmy, and this is like in beginning of November. He says, Eddie, oh God, what? By the way, where will we be sales-wise come January with Jimmy Page? We got the rest of this month, December, and we have Christmas. Where will we be in January? What about returns and also net sales? See, in sales, you got net.
Yeah.
You got this net sales, and you got the net sales after returns and anything else that may come back from salvage or something else. And the only thing you can count on is net in terms of actual cash. And he wants an answer. He don't want you to sit here and think too long or say...
He expects you to know that number.
Yeah, I'll get back to you. So I thought for about probably not even 30 seconds, and I gave him a number. He said, okay. And then we went on with the meeting. David gets up and walks out.
Wow.
Come January of the next year, we're in some kind of meeting someplace, and he walks up to me and said, Eddie, that was a good number. You were right on it. Good. And turns around and walks away. That's how he is.
Did you ever make any mistakes?
No. I know one day he came to me, and we were working Aerosmith. And he said, Eddie, I think Motley Crue, which is over on Atlantic, is going to be number one next week. I would sure like to have Aerosmith number one. I said, okay, let me see what I can do. Then he turns around, walks away. And next week, guess who was number one? Aerosmith.
And what did you do?
Made 5 phone calls.
What would those calls be like? Who are you calling or what are you saying?
I had such a good relationship with the owners of Musicland, with the owners of Tower. Every major account in the country I had a good relationship with. Very good relationship. And all I had to do was make a phone call.
Wow.
And what happens, those numbers come from someone reporting that week which their number one record was. And they all said, don't worry, we'll take care of you. Don't worry, we'll take care of you. So within 2 hours, it went from Motley Crue to Aerosmith, number one in Billboard.
Wow.
Wow. All right, one of the names that caught my immediate attention was the chairman of the board, Frank Sinatra.
Oh, Mr. Sinatra, sweetheart. Just a real sweetheart.
Now, you were at Warner Brothers, and I'm just trying to guess on based on the timeline, because he had his own label, which eventually was purchased by Warner Brothers. They bought Reprise.
Reprise, yes. See, he was, I think Reprise was at Warner's before, wasn't it, one time?
I thought Frank developed that label separately, but I don't know. But I know that it ended up...
He was at Capitol with Reprise.
And he started Reprise because he left Capitol in kind of a huff.
Yeah, he talked to Mo Austin, who was the chairman of Warner Brothers, and the chairman came down and said, Eddie, Mr. Sinatra's getting ready to bring over himself as an artist and also his label, Reprise. I said, great. And what happened at that point, Frank Sinatra sent all the guys that was doing what I was doing a letter from himself, signed by himself, saying, you guys are taking good care of these things while I was gone. I'm back in the saddle again. And this is just before we released New York, New York. Said, I want to get back in there. I need your help. What can you do for me? And my comment was, anything you want. But he said, fine, I'd like to have a hit record. Wonderful. And we didn't see him that much because he wasn't really in the office. And we would see him from time to time, or he may go on the road if he was working and see him. He kind of stayed away from us and kept his distance. And that was okay because we took care of his projects. None of his projects had a problem. And if you remember, New York is one of the biggest records he ever had. Yeah. But a great guy, easy to deal with.
Lost the Grammy to Christopher Cross.
Sailing?
No. Was it Sailing?
I think it was Sailing. Yeah. Christopher Cross, and he was...
Yeah, and he was big for many
feared
years.
Feared for his life after that.
Yeah, that was, he was a Warner artist, too.
Yeah, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's the only record he ever had. He was from Australia?
I don't remember where he was from.
I don't know.
All I know is it was 10 amazing songs, and then I don't think he ever did anything after that.
Never had any more.
Obviously, when Frank came over, Sammy Davis Jr. was with him at the time.
No, actually, Sammy Davis Jr. was at Motown.
And you said he ran you wild, didn't he?
Yeah, because I told him he's the fastest little walking black man I ever seen. He get out of the car. Come on, Eddie. And I'm 6'1". I'm trying to keep up. No, but we got along really well together. He was a great guy. And easy to talk to. You would know that's who you were talking to. He was great. And I used to meet him at the different shows. So he used to do Mike Douglas all the time.
Yeah.
In Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
And so wherever he came to a town, if it was in my territory, I would meet him there and handle all the business. If he had any problems, that's what I was there for. And I would meet the car when they pull up to the parking lot or to the curb. He'd hop out here and out to Beast, his new wife. And he said, we got to go get some clothes. We got to buy some jewelry. We got to go here. I said, but you got to do this TV show first. Okay, well, let's get started. Where are we going? Follow me. And I had to almost run.
He was a worker, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. He never stopped.
Yeah.
Never stopped. Didn't have an ounce of fat on him at all, and just total energy all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A remarkable performer. We have to take a very quick break, and our next segment is presented by our friends at the McAllen Theater. We will continue in just a moment.
From Grammy-winning songwriters Brandi Clark and Shane McAnally, Tony-winning writer Robert Horn, and Tony-winning director Jack O'Brien comes a musical about corn.
Corn!
Shucked, the Broadway musical comedy is about an unlikely hero, a lovable con man, and an amazing battle for the heart and soil of Cobb County. Shucked, play in McCallum Theater, November 25th through 30th. Tickets at McCallumTheater.org.
And we are back. And this segment is presented to you by the McCallum Theater. Great shows all year long. You can visit McCallumTheater.org. You worked with Smokey Robinson.
Oh, yeah. Actually, Smokey's office was right down the hall from mine at Motown. And I'd be listening to all the new music, trying to determine what and how we're going to work things. And Smokey, and see, now keep in mind, if you work with Smokey at Motown, you didn't call him Smokey. It was just Smoke.
Oh, okay.
Because I think he thought Smokey was juvenile, maybe a little bit. And you're all adults talking about Smokey. It's like Freddie. No, Smoke. Smoke. It was just Smoke. And Smoke was down the hall from me, and he would call, Eddie, turn down that damn music. I'm trying to write a song. I said, turn yours up. but yeah, we used to have a good relationship with him. And the time before last when he was here, I went down to see him, and I was not even sure if he totally recognized who I was. Mm. I'm really thinking he's starting to get a little faded there. Because I was with, gosh, what's his name? He used to be a radio announcer here at 102, Dan McGrath.
Oh, Dan McGrath, yeah, Dan.
Yeah, I was with Dan, and we were backstage. And so I went back, and I said, hey, Smoke, how you doing? And he looked at you, yeah, as if, do I know you?
Yeah.
And he was always cordial. If he didn't know me at all, he would have been the same way. Extremely cordial. And you would walk away thinking that he did know you, even if he didn't. So I wasn't really sure, and that's the last time I seen him. But we always had a good relationship. I'd meet him on the road, and I don't even know if I should tell this.
Well, that's the one you should tell.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
No, he'd kill me if I tell this.
He's not listening. Wouldn't it be awesome if he was?
That'd be really cool. But
anyway, he is married once again, and I knew his first wife very well. Oh, gosh.
Claudette.
Thank you, dear. And he had his kids, and we would always be on the road together quite a bit, doing things like the Uptown Theater, the Apollo in New York, the Washington in D.C. And we would do all these theaters. And if they were in town, I would go in town where they were, if that was my territory, spend time, make sure everything was right. And what I would do, I would get the guys to come out. And a lot of guys had them big, jocks had them big record shows at that time, like High Lit, you remember that name? And in Philadelphia, he was one of the biggest jocks in the country at the time. And he would have a record hop, have 2,000 or 3,000 kids there.
Oh, my gosh.
And they had to put the money in a toilet paper cardboard box because there was so many dollars, it wouldn't fit in anything else. And so they would pay.
That sounds safe.
Yeah, they would pay. They would say, okay, Eddie, can you get the Miracles to come? I said, yeah, they'll come if I asked him to. There are two things was happening. I wanted them to play my records. And they wanted to have Smokey Robinson come to their hop. So what they would do, they would provide me with a limousine to go pick up the group if at the bin back of the theater, bring them to the record hop, let them do one pantomime on the hit record, put them back in the limousine, get them back to the theater in time for the next show, and next week, my records would be on the air.
Wow.
That's such a great story.
It's not payola because I didn't pay him anything.
No, it's just a favor.
Paying a favor for
a career span these incredible years. But yeah. When you look at the diversity of artists that you work with, and you start out with people like Ray Charles and Dionne Warwick, but then you end up with Metallica and U2 and Aerosmith, you as an executive, you had to really ride the change in musical taste that the public was going through.
I think what was happening was because I was a musician, I could understand and appreciate all types of music and all forms. So I wasn't pigeonholed to just one thing. Mm. And at one time, they wanted me, when I did the thing with George Benson, they wanted me at Warner's to just stay into the urban soul music. I said, I'm not going to do that. And Eddie Rosenblatt, who was like a godfather to me at Warner Brothers, he was president, he said, if you don't want to do that, what do you want to do? I said, I want to have an entire possibility of working everyone we have on the label. Because I know music, I know what they're doing, I can appreciate what they're doing, I can converse with them, and we can have a good conversation. Doobie Brothers, Tower Power, I talked to all those guys and understand, and when I started giving them musical thoughts that I had about what they were playing, all of a sudden, the whole barrier had fallen down. And that's why I was ready to work on those.
You guys are speaking the same language because you were a musician as well.
And they knew that, so we had a great relationship.
A lot of the guys that worked at the executive level probably didn't have that kind of musical experience.
No, they didn't have the kind of musical experience. Plus, the labels was already programmed, and it's a fact of life that the black guys worked only black music, and then the white guys would work only the pop music. But then in an area where you didn't have a black guy and you only had one guy, he was a white guy, and he was working Barry White or whoever it may be. And so I'm saying to myself, if he can work those, how come I can't work these? So I went back and made that challenge. And I got a lot of feedback, pushback, I might say, but I was determined. I wasn't going to be put into a hole where I couldn't do anything else.
And one of the early ones that was a little off that track was Bonnie Raitt.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Talk about the relationship with her, because she's still going strong.
Oh, yeah. Bonnie, the main thing is she was doing a lot of things that was very urban in her sound and even semi-little country. But she was a great guitarist and a great vocalist as well as a writer.
Yeah.
And she was just, it was so easy to get along with her. You say hello and she was right there. And most artists who had talent, who wasn't afraid of what they were doing or wasn't afraid of that they may do something wrong, say something wrong, was very open. I love Bonnie Raitt, and I've worked with Don Henley from the Eagles.
Yeah.
Because David had signed them when he was at Elektra.
Yeah.
He started that group. And so Don Henley was one of the greatest guys you could ever get. Matter of fact, one day when he was doing a show at the Forum, one of the ladies at WIA, which is the distributor, really wanted to go see him. I had gotten tickets for and everything, but she had ended up having an accident, and she was in the hospital. So we went to the show that night. She couldn't come, of course. So I told Don Henley what had happened. And you know what he did? He wrote a nice note for her and set the music.
That's cool.
The kind of guy he was.
Yeah. That's a class act.
Yeah, yeah. So some of these guys are just really model citizens that you love to be around, not because of their talent, but because of their humanity.
So let's talk about George Clinton. And the Funkadelics.
He just scared me to death.
Because he wasn't one of the ones you were talking about.
He He'd walk up to you. Most of the time you've seen George, it was dark at nighttime because he'd be at the show, be at the Apollo someplace backstage. And he had hair.
He was bigger than life.
He looked like the Loch Ness Monster. He'll walk up to you. Hey, Eddie. You look around and hope for the best.
Any crazy stories about the Funkadelics?
No, I didn't spend much time talking. With Funkadelic had him. Yeah. But I didn't spend much time talking to George.
Yeah.
The best guy he had with him was David Worrell, who played keyboard. And this guy was absolutely incredible. And I would hang a lot with him. But the other guys in that band, like the guys who called themselves management assistants, were a bunch of jerks, be quite honest about them. Because they got with him, they didn't have any background skills, nothing to put him in that position, but they knew George, and George wanted his entourage.
This is his posse that followed him.
And right. They'll come around. One day I get to my office, and there's two of them in my office when I get there, and one's sitting in the back of my desk in the chair with his feet up. I'm looking at this fool. I said, I beg your pardon. Man, we got Funkadelic. I said, you better get your funky ass out of here. I know that.
Get out of my chair.
Yeah, get out of here.
What about Curtis Mayfield?
Oh, the love of my life. I tell you, I love Curtis Mayfield when I was even in the military because I was hearing Gypsy Woman back in those days.
Yeah.
Now, Curtis was the nicest guy you ever want to meet. And he didn't care if you didn't like what he was doing. Because he would say about the jocks, if they didn't like my record, that's their problem, it's not mine. I'm doing what I want to do. And his whole idea was...
Artist right there.
Yeah, and he did this one cover when it was at Warner's that the plant, I got it in my phone somewhere, that the plant decided they didn't want to put out because they thought it was a little bit too controversial. And so the record plant, which we own, decided... We're not going to print this cover. We think it's saying too much without saying enough. So that's when Curtis and I became real tight, because I was working with him on trying to get this cover printed, and to the point of getting ready to go to court. He did the album. This was after Superfly, and he's hot as he can be, and he has this cover, a cover, but I can show it to you. It's a picture of a billboard, and it looks like one of those Chevrolet commercials. See the USA in your Chevrolet. And he had the white couple in there with the kids smiling, going through the countryside, and under the sign was this like bread line of all these black folks with baskets and things trying to get some food at the bread pantry.
Oh, wow.
And it was a total contradiction of what was on the billboard.
Yeah.
And they just didn't want to put it out. And actually, they never did. It came out later when he left the label and it came out. But at that time, I was fighting with them to get that item released, because we were real tight and I was going to look out for him. Plus, I thought they should not be the ones to decide what we released.
And he wasn't going to bend. He had an idea of what he wanted his music to be.
That's what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And he called me up one day. I'm in the office. And he said, "Hi, Eddie." I said, "Hey, who is this?" "This is Kurt." I said, "Kurt?" I said, "Kurt who?" "Curtis." And what I found out, if he calls you and you can call him Kurt, that was a sign.
You're in.
Yeah, not Curtis, just Kurt. And from that point on, it was just Kurt. So I worked with him up until the time he had that accident in New York when the lights fell on his back and neck and broke his spinal cord. And the last time I saw Curtis, we were in New York at the Hilton Hotel, right across from the Radio City Music Hall. And I felt someone tugging on my suit, my tuxedo jacket. And I'm looking around, and it's about 20 of us in the lobby, and just getting ready to wait for our cars. I look down, it's Curtis Mayfield in his wheelchair. I said, "Wow." Yeah. And so I bent down and we talked for about maybe a half hour. And I said, "Hey, I gotta go, my car's here." But it was the saddest thing, because the only thing he could move was his hand a little bit and his neck. Other than that, everything was paralyzed. So we talked for as long as we could. And I had his number, because he had moved to Atlanta too. He left Chicago. And that night at the Grammys, they had a whole thing with Bruce Springsteen, Bonnie Raitt, two or three other artists that did a tribute to him on with his songs. It was beautiful. And he made a couple little comments. And it just snatched a tear from your eye.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, it really was.
Such a tragedy.
And he was a good friend. Anything I needed him to do, he would do. There was never any question. And it was, I can hear him now talking to me, because his voice was so distinct and he's talking really slow. And I said, "Curtis, I'm just curious, how in the world did you come up with the idea of Gypsy Woman? You're sitting in the ghetto side, west side of Chicago. You're still a gypsy woman."
Gypsies weren't a big thing there.
Yeah, but that's how his mind worked. He would come up with all these incredible ideas that you can't imagine where they came from. And if you listen to the lyrics of Gypsy Woman, it tells a really complete story. And the story is a beautiful story. And they woke up that morning and they were gone. And there's actually more lyrics to the song that was on the record. And if he ever does it live, there's a video out there right now on YouTube where he does it live, and it's another whole section of that song. And
I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, you got to hear it, because it says, "When I woke up that morning and she was gone, never would she know how much I loved her. She was just beautiful." Oh. Yeah, she was a gypsy woman.
Tell us about the Jacksons, your relationship with them.
Did I give you that picture?
You did.
Okay. Joe, because Michael and I became good friends when he was that young, and Joe had said, "I really want you," now Joe's the father, "I really want you to spend time with Michael, because he really likes you, and we got to keep him safe, because he didn't have a life, let's be honest."
Yeah.
He didn't have a life. He couldn't go anywhere, couldn't do anything. He was surrounded all the time. But when he was with me, he felt calm. I made sure he was protected. I didn't take him anywhere where I knew there would be an abundance of people, because he didn't need it, and I sure didn't need it. So we always tried to stay in a situation where there was calmness and no real problems that we were going to have. And the nicest little guy, and he grew up and still a nice guy. The last time I seen him before he passed away was at Quincy Jones' house. Now, Quincy Jones would have a barbecue every year, and he was flying his chef from Europe. the barbecue wasn't that good. I don't know why.
European barbecue?
Yeah, yeah, no, I wouldn't trust that.
It doesn't ring well.
No.
So he replied.
It's boiled barbecue.
He would have everybody there, and we would come to the party, and Michael drove up that day in his purple Rolls Royce. And so he came in, and we got a chance to spend a little time. And then I was in, like, Quincy's, there's a studio, we had a room there with TVs and everything. And these two girls was in there watching cartoons. So I go out, because it's time to eat, and Quincy says, hey, where's Michael? It's time to eat, go get Michael. So I go looking for Michael, and I go back to that room. Michael's in there with the two girls watching cartoons.
Wow.
He never grew up.
He was always a little kid.
All in all.
He couldn't grow up. Because it wasn't never allowed.
Was he the most talented all-in-all artist that you ever worked with? Or could you even say who was?
I wouldn't say that it was. I got to give a lot of credit to Ray Charles.
Yeah. He was the first record you ever owned, wasn't it, Ray Charles?
He had that song out, Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying. Yeah, that was the first record I ever bought. I love the orchestration. I love the bass lines. And I love how he delivered the lyrics. Because it made sense to me. It wasn't one of those songs that didn't have any value to it. The lyrics made sense, and I could listen to it, and I could put myself into that song. And it made me feel good.
That's your first record. And later down the road, you're working with Ray Charles.
I'm working with Ray Charles.
That must have been just crazy.
Oh, God, I got to tell you this story. How's our time? We're okay?
We're fine.
When I'm already hired, because I left Warner's and Universal and David, and we were doing our own thing. Because I was now 50-something. I wanted to get away from that. I had to be there every day. And I wanted to take a little break from that. So Ray Charles hired me and my staff, because I had four people that we had this little company called Innate. So I went in to see Ray after he had already hired us to one of his other affiliates in the label. And so this is my first time actually sitting down with him. So he's in back of it. Did you see the movie Ray?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's the same exact desk and office we were in. He never changed anything.
Wow.
Yeah, okay. The walls were the same. He had these tile floors, and he wore really hard heel shoes. So when he walked down the hall, he could tell where he was because the sound changed if the door was open.
Wow.
And so he walked down the hall. Oh, good morning, Margaret. She's in there. But that's incredible memory. So anyway, we're sitting there talking, and I'm already hired, so I don't have to impress him. I'm trying to get hired because he wanted me to come. And I said, by the way, we call him Mr. C in the office. By the way, Mr. C, I got a cousin that said he used to work for you, but I don't ever believe a word the son of a bitch says. He ain't no damn good. He lies about everything. The whole family dislikes this guy. He ain't worth a shit. But he said he worked for you. Really? Because then he got that little frown on his face there. I said, yeah, but we don't believe he worked for you. What was his name? I said, Marcus. Marcus Belgrade. What? He leaned back in the chair with his glasses, put his arms together. Man, that boy could play. And from that point on, we were like that.
Oh, that's a great story.
Yeah.
What did Marcus play?
Trumpet.
Trumpet.
Oh, and he was also a funk brother of Motown, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. He passed away a couple of years ago, but he was an incredible musician.
Wow, great.
So last week, I was trying to reach Eddie, and he called me back later, and he says, hey, I'm sorry I couldn't answer. I ran over to see Kool and the Gang.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, okay. He just ran over to see Kool from Kool and the Gang. Who do you still hang out with today that you've known for so long?
Otis Wilms.
Yeah.
From the Temptations.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, cool. I'm trying to think. There's not many of them left anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
It's getting nervous for me. I got to pinch myself once in a while just to see if I'm still here. But if you think about all the folks I work with at Motown and how many are gone now, all the guys I work with at Warner Brothers, see, everyone seems to assimilate me with Motown, which is fine because I love working for Motown. But I was at Warner Brothers 24 years.
That was the length of the biggest part of your career.
And I was only at Motown about 10 years, total 10, 12 years. Because I left Motown, went to Warner Brothers, and then Clarence Avant, if you know that name at all. Remember his wife got killed up in Beverly Hills one day?
I don't know the story.
This is Godfather. So there's a show on Netflix about Clarence Avant. And Clarence said, Eddie, I need you back here at Motown. I said, Clarence, I don't want to come back over there. Eddie, I said, I need you back over here at Motown. When can you start? I'll be there Monday, my brother Clarence. Not a problem. I'll be there Monday. Because he knows and knew everybody. And I called him up one day when a beautiful wife over there and I got married, and he was supposed to be at the wedding. And he called me up the same day, said, Eddie, I know I'm supposed to be there at your wedding, but I can't make it. I just got a call from Bill. Oh. And he said, Bill, I'm talking about Bill Clinton.
Oh, the Bill.
Yeah, yeah. And I got to go to Arabia. They're talking about some planes that they want to purchase. And Bill wants me to go over there and begin to have the conversation. I said, well, I guess I can understand. You're not making the wedding.
That's a good excuse. That's yeah. not the only acceptable excuse.
Yeah. When the president calls you.
Yep. But if you need anything, see, that's what was so good about it. If you need something, you know who you could call for whatever problem it may be out there. And this thing is changing so much in the world now. The whole record businesses went through a revolution that you can't even imagine how it was. Yeah. God bless little Swift.
Taylor Swift.
Yeah, bless little Taylor Swift. Because she can do it by herself. She has that kind of popularity.
Right.
Yeah. But if you go to a record company now, who wants to put the money out? It's too expensive to put the money out, because even if you make the record, make a great record, how are you going to get it played?
Even if the outlets
are gone.
Yeah, even if you do, it ends up on Spotify and you get 3 cents on the dollar
If you get that.
All right, we're almost out of time, but I want to ask about this because there is, I'm sure, some layer of dovetailing here, but you also worked with some of the biggest Broadway shows.
Oh, yeah.
Now, how did you make that leap to go from record executive to doing sales? These were big shows. Dreamgirls, Miss Saigon, Les Miserables. These were the biggest.
I've heard of those.
Yeah.
It was very easy, and I'll tell you why. David Geffen owned all of them.
Okay.
That'll help. There we go.
There's the connection.
Yeah.
Okay, so then you just went and started working on those shows and selling them.
Yeah, I worked on them as well as I was working on everything else. We didn't stop working on this to do this. You had the ability to work on everything. So I'd go to New York. I'd meet the producer of the show. I'd meet a lot of the cast members. Watch the show a couple of times, listen to the tracks, and decide which ones you want to take to the marketplace to promote the show. Cast was easy. That's a beautiful song.
Yeah.
Dreamgirls wasn't that hard. That was easy.
Yeah.
And then we had Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah.
That was ours. And Les Miserables. And
yeah, I Dreamed a Dream. That was the... That.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And when Les Miserables was, it says, bring him home.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That snatches a tear from your eye. It sure does. And so you love working on those shows. I'm sitting there watching Miss Saigon one night, and I'm in David's seats at the theater, and the lights are all off. And when they come up for intermission, I'm sitting there looking around. Kirk Douglas sitting right next to me. The Spartacus.
Spartacus right
amazing.
Next to me.
Yeah, Spartacus. I said, oh, shoot.
Eddie, I read in 2019 you did an interview with Liner Notes, and they asked you a question about your legacy. What would it be? And you said, I hope my legacy is that I did the right things. Do you feel like you did?
Oh, you know what? I would say for 90% of the time I did.
Yeah.
My job wasn't to hurt anybody. It was to help. I worked on a lot of things. I did this program called Black Music is Green because I wanted to get more African-Americans into the business, but not just in promotion, but also in sales and marketing. And I had a great relationship with the folks at NARM, the president and so forth, which is the biggest music organization in the country. And I asked them if I could put a program together, could I show it at NARM? And they gave me the go-ahead to do it. So we put together about $250,000, made videos. I got a professor out of Illinois, that University in Illinois, south of Chicago. I can't think of the name of it. Anyway, so he came on board, and we did incredible research about who goes to the store, how long do they stay there, what do they read, what colors are more infatuating for them. Is it red? Is it red, white, black? And how high off the floor should it be? We got all that information on how we can now better market to the entire group. And when they come in the store, how long do they read an album label, or how long do they stay? Do they come by themselves, or do they come with two people? And we had all that information and went back to NARM that next year, and we showed that video. And then I got the biggest guys in the country from the various distributors come up on stage with me, and we had a great conversation. And they liked it so well, I had to do it twice.
But Data is king, and you had Data.
Yeah.
Data
and
is
we
king.
Showed it, and it was a hit because it made sense. We weren't trying to fake anything, but we wanted to be able to say to you, if you're a label, you got to think about marketing, and it's not just the Joe's Fish Market. You got to look about marketing to Tower and to all these other big stores, just like you're marketing Alice Cooper or anyone else. And they were not doing that. So what we did, we got people jobs that didn't have jobs before. They didn't need a whole lot of background experience to put up merchandising. And we got people jobs, and it worked out.
We got a master class.
Yeah.
We got a master class for the last hour. This was fantastic.
Yeah, very cool. Oh. Eddie, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely.
It was our pleasure.
Yeah.
It was our
this
pleasure.
This is really cool, Eddie. Thank you so much. I'm glad we got you here.
Yeah, we only hit about 10% of it.
I know. I feel like we scraped the tip of the iceberg, and we'll have you back.
Well, that's because every question that he answered led me to another one. I'm like, no, I can't do that. I got 20 more here.
Yeah.
It was
It was an interesting time, and I sometimes wonder, people said, did you enjoy it? And I said, well, let me think about it for a minute, because sometimes I did. One of the things I enjoyed, too, is because of my affiliation, I was on the board of the American Heart Association for California. I was a West Coast chairman for the AJC, which nobody knew.
The American
couldn't believe.
Jewish
Committee. Yeah. Then I was on the Black Music Association. I had dinner with Rosa Parks. Wow. I mean, I met all these people in my career that I just fell in love with and was able to get a lot of things done with them. And I was able to call them if I needed anything at all. And having that ability to be safe, because I know how to keep my mouth shut.
Yeah.
Start with that. And when you're dealing with some of these people, you got to learn how to do that. Yeah, you got
to
keep
it to
yourself.
And this is all because J-Mo made him play the bass.
Play the bass.
That's
where it all started.
We're in Stump's jacket.
Yeah.
This is phenomenal. Thank you so much.
Well, one day we'll do it again.
Absolutely.
Get to the second sequel.
That sounds good to me.
All right. On behalf of Randy Florence, my co-host John McMullen, our producer, I'm Patrick Evans. We want to thank Skip and his entire team here at Little Bar. You're listening to Big Conversations, Little Bar. We're delighted. Be sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode.
Big Conversations, Little Bar is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System. This podcast is available in audio and video format. Visit our website at www.bigconversationslittlebar.com. New episodes are released every Monday.
Athletes and dreamers, stars of the screen, leaders and builders, and all in between. Little bar at big conversations, little